When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to In Conversation, a Dublab podcast where each week we will bring you interviews from the Dublab Radio Archives.
We'd only done a few tiny gigs. So we were very inexperienced, but so full of enthusiasm and ideas and exploring different musical styles. And so that record was kind of different from any of the others we did, really, because it was exploring all the various possibilities, possible futures we could have as a band. And it's interesting how it ended up being a very influential record, I think, for a lot of different bands who picked up different aspects of the record and developed them. It was very much like a cult thing, and I think people were... It was a kind of very much like an art school crowd who were coming to the shows at first. And so it being the early 70s, you know, the... kind of very well dressed, taking great care with how they looked and all that kind of stuff. And it just everybody seemed to have dyed hair, different colours, and all that kind of thing. And we had friends who were, you know, art students and fashion students and so on, and they helped us to put together the look of the band and the look of the. Of the album cover, in particular Anthony Price, who is a great friend of mine, became a really close friend. His friend, who was an American photographer living in London, called Carl Stoker, who was terrific as well. It was all very kind of cottage industry, you call it, where, you know, no assistants or anything. We all did it all ourselves. It was a kind of do-it-yourself kind of thing, kind of with the music and with the look of the thing, too. And that's how I met Brian Eno, is because he had a tape recorder. We didn't have a tape recorder, even. Andy Mackay said, "Oh, I know this guy who is into electronic music, and he's got a tape recorder." And I said, "Oh, great! Let's get him to come over." Eno came with this huge German heavyweight tape recorder, which he could hardly carry, and set it up, and he recorded some of the things we were doing, and then he got involved fiddling around with Andy Mackay's sort of. One of the early synthesizers called a VCS3. And from that night onwards, he stayed with the band, treating the sounds of the guitar and the oboe and the sax. And we pursued all these interesting textures and sounds and stuff, which was a... We wanted to be kind of experimental, but at the same time, we kind of wanted to do that with tunes and with interesting lyrics. And the lyrics to begin with were very primitive, but they got better as the first year developed. And so by the time that we made the second album, For Your Pleasure, I was really getting into the wordplay and image conjuring that you can do with words in song. And it's extraordinary how different the second album was from the first. how much we'd learned in that first 6 months. In every dream, I'm a heartache, really, and do The Strand and Editions of You. I like performing those ones to this day because, and they're in the set we've been touring around because I like singing the words and they're sort of character songs and I never get tired of performing those ones. So many great saxophone players that I listened to over the years, and it's a big part of my music life, listening to sax and using it in, on record too. First with Andy Mackay, then people like Dave Sanborn. I've been a Charlie Parker fanatic, devotee since I was 10 or 11 years old. So I love that sound when it's played well. Charlie Parker with strings, which is a kind of a record that some jazz people don't like because I think it's too mainstream. But since he's kind of, I don't know, he seems to be flying and floating over the strings that play on that record. And it's actually his favourite record, I believe. It was his favourite record. And he felt he'd done something really different, which he had, and plays such beautiful standards. The 78th that I bought at that time, which were kind of a mixed bag of like Fats Domino, Little Richard, early Elvis, and very important, the Ink Spots records that my Auntie Enid gave me. She was a big fan of the Ink Spots and Nat King Cole, people like that, crooner type singers. Prove how versatile we could be on that first record. So we would do one song and say, let's do another one like this, and then that would lead to something else. Let's do something which is different again from that. And at the end of the day, it was quite an interesting mixture of things. I mean, of course, it didn't have a single, and that was the only complaint that the record company had when we presented it to them. And they didn't even know, they didn't complain, they just said, there's nothing really for the radio. And so they said, do you have anything else? And I said, well, there's a song that I'm sort of nearly finished writing, which we then went and recorded after the album had come out in England. And that was called Virginia Plain, and that became a sort of a record they could play on the radio. So we kind of made up as we went along, and I mean, Eno, for some of those gigs, was in the audience mixing the sound and adding the odd effect here and there, and wasn't on stage for some of the first shows. Then eventually we got someone to mix the sound. Actually, we got Phil Manzanera, who later ended up playing guitar. And the very first shows, he was mixing some for us. Can't Let Go, which actually, I wrote when I was living here in the mid-70s in a street called Quest Away up in Bel Air, and I mentioned that in the lyric. And they were kind of quite wild times for me. And I wrote that song here in Los Angeles, but then we recorded it in Switzerland, that whole album called The Bride Stripped Bare, which is actually one of the best records I've ever made. And it was the first time I ever worked with any American musicians. I'd usually always worked with people from either, you know, in Roxy, or I'd done a couple of solo albums with people like Chris Spedding and all English session players and so on, and who are great musicians. But I was really keen to work with a couple of people from out here. Student, and I famously hitchhiked down to London, which in those days we didn't think was a big deal, but you know, it would take many hours of hitchhiking to get there from Newcastle in the north of England, depending on how many kind truck drivers there were in the vicinity. And I went down to see the Stax Review with Otis Redding, Salmon Day, Eddie Floyd, you know, Steve Cropper, Booker T, all those incredible musicians from the Stax label who were touring. And it was shortly before Otis Redding died, so I was very lucky to see that. And it had a huge impact on me. When I was much younger, 11 or 12, going to see Jazz at the Philharmonic, which was a kind of touring band with kind of Ella Fitzgerald and Dizzy Gillespie and various all-star jazz players, you know. And that was pretty incredible. I was kind of blown away by that. And it was like... all these moments are very important. Oh, and the same year, I went to see Bill Haley, actually, which was that was the first rock and roll tour of Europe, the Bill Haley Band, which was kind of rockabilly, really. But it was the first kind of beginnings of rock music, you know. Yeah, that album, which was called These Foolish Things, was the... it was a great record to make. It was after the second Roxy Music album, For Your Pleasure, and I remember I was feeling burned out by the writing, and I thought, I'd really like to make another record straight away, and as a cathartic experience, you know. And so I did. I thought, well, it'd be nice to just choose some songs that I really thought were kind of influential to me and interesting, and put them all together in the way that people, Sinatra and Crosby and so on, all the big singers of the 20th century, really, and Elvis, they weren't songwriters as such. They were performers, interpreters. So I thought, well, I'll do an album like that, where I'm like the singer and the producer. It was educational for me, and helped me to perfect the craft of record making too. You know, it gave me a lot more experience. It must be very hard, as each year goes by, for new bands to, I guess, to find a new sound, because, you know, there's been so much music since 1960. I mean, there's been a lot of music, with, you know, guitars turned up and loud and stuff. So, you know, it's nice making a lot of noise, but it's also great if you make very little noise and do quiet things, and I'm beginning to discover that.
In Conversation was produced by DubLab, a nonprofit radio station broadcasting live from Los Angeles since 1999. Sound editing and theme song by Matea Baim. For more programming, visit dublab.com. And thank you for listening.